Hey everybody, welcome to the 440 Guitar Podcast. I am your host, Jarrell Powell. Thank you so much for tuning up. You can catch the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anchor.fm/440. You can also follow the podcast on Instagram at the 440 Guitar Podcast to get updates on the episodes coming out, and then also checking out just different videos and whatnot on the Instagram for the 440 Guitar Podcast. I tend to like to take a bunch of videos and clips of just like moments of like different artists playing that it's have an affinity for, just really inspire me. So feel free to follow that. And if you know of an artist that you think would be great for me to speak to, feel free to reach out to me directly. You can do that via DM through the Instagram, or you could also do that through the email. You can email me at the440podcast@gmail.com. So feel free to do that if you'd like to do so. Today, I am very excited to speak with this guest. He's a professional guitar player. He's a guitar educator as well. He has master classes from various such as like the massive JTC master classes available. He's worked with some of the top guys in the business, you know, Tom Quayle and the list goes on. And just has a great fluidity of playing that I'm really happy to have him here on the show, the 440 Guitar Podcast. It's excited to have Martin Miller on the show here. How you doing, man?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Of course. It's funny. I remember we were just speaking off air that forgetting as far as, you know, the time change. It's like, oh, I'm in Germany, so.
that's a almost daily thing I'm battling with.
Really?
Because I teach through Skype, so.
Yeah, it's like, what time struggle. Is class? Yeah. I get a bunch of tired students. Oh man, yeah. Well, that looks like a pretty fun room, though. I mean, aside from
proper man cave.
Yeah, exactly.
Get all the toys.
Right. Yeah. Phenomenal. So as far before we get started, just kind of talking. How's everything been when it comes to? Well, I guess as far as for you doing your teaching and whatnot, through Skype and online, I'm sure that definitely is a huge benefit. A beneficial thing given what's still going on or been going on for 2 years, right?
That is so true, mm-hmm. And I'm lucky that I started teaching online, I think 12 years ago.
Right.
I know a lot of people. In the past 2 years jumped onto the online teaching train and found it really hard to just make ends meet and to acquire students. I've been lucky that I decided to adopt very early the online teaching thing. And I remember when I started out, I had so many people back when I was still going to college. I had so many people laugh at me and kind of scoff at the fact that I was doing that through Skype, but I always thought, this is really good because, first of all, anybody anywhere can pick their teacher of choice. You're not restricted by who happens to be around.
Right.
Second of all, you can be in the comfort of your home, play through your own gear. And third of all, for me, it's like the 45 minutes are over. I can turn off the computer and be at home. I don't have to commute. I don't have, it's just a great way to save time too. Yes, there's an element that isn't great, and it's the fact that you cannot really jam together. Mm. You cannot play together simultaneously. You kind of have to do that. You have to solve that with backing tracks, but there's ways around that. I still think it's better to have a great teacher online than to have a mediocre teacher in real life.
That's good. Yeah. I would have to definitely agree that makes a lot of sense. So here on the 440 Guitar Podcast, we're really big on origin stories, how people got to where they are today. So just to start off the conversation, tell me about your earliest memory of music.
Huh. I think that's just me listening to my father's record collection. Mm. Listening to the Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd, Genesis. There were some Miles Davis records in there as well, some... Mm. Billy Cobham, all the really good, awesome 70s stuff.
Wow.
I was fortunate to be brought up on that.
Yeah, he sounds like a pretty legit vinyl collector, you know, a record collector. It seems like
well, I'm not. I don't even have a vinyl player. But my father used to. I mean, that used to be the only medium we had. That was before CDs. I'm born in '85. That was before CDs were a thing, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, we had a nice vinyl collection. Had a vinyl player. Had a proper stereo system. I was the funny thing is so what you have to understand is that I was born in GDR. Former GDR, so I was not. I'm not West German. I'm East German.
Oh, okay.
So I was born behind. I don't know how much you know about the history of that, but I'm basically born behind the wall in East, in East Germany, and so there was no availability of Western media like it is.
Oh wow!
Like it was in West Germany, or like it is now. So my father basically had to pull all sorts of semi-legal or illegal strings to get hold of those records.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a tough time, especially for the adults. But like as a child, I didn't really know the difference, right? But on the other hand, though, you know, I'm not sure how old you are, but I'm certain you can relate the fact that there was a sort of scarcity when it comes to the availability of media.
Yeah,
it made you appreciate what you had so much more. Like even when I bought my first record for my pocket money, that even if it may not have been the greatest record of all time, I held that record near and dear to my heart and listened to it a million times over.
Right.
So, and that was with anything I could get my hands on, basically. I would just immerse myself in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I was born in 88. So I think the first record I purchased was CD. It was, I think it was the rock band Trapped.
And then, oh my God, that's the guy with the Twitter meltdown.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Coldplay, Rush of Blood to the Head was my second.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. My first record that I bought for my own money was the H Block's Time to Move. I'm sure you have no idea who that is.
I have no idea.
They were that's kind interesting, of a, though. A German Limp Bizkit copy.
Really? Oh wow! Yeah.
But I loved that record. I thought it was a great band, and they did sound really good. I need to go right after this. I'm gonna go on YouTube or something and Google those songs, and I want to see how they what impression I have nowadays of them. But I remember being really really. I loved it. I used to love it.
That's so interesting. It's funny. I always think about like. Sometimes like the guilty pleasure, like artists or just like music, you know, where you're just like, I shouldn't like this, but I do.
Oh man, I really do not believe in guilty pleasures. If I like something, I like something. It's not like food, right? Where you can poison yourself essentially. But, I really like pop music, for example.
Yeah.
Certain types of pop, old pop music.
Yeah.
So I'm a massive Phil Collins fan, for example. I'm
not me too. Absolutely.
I love the guy. I was just researching some disco music as well. I listened to some Diana Ross. Thought it was amazing.
Oh yeah,
it's great. God knows, it's Earth, Wind, and Fire. I've been binging those a little bit lately. Amazing.
Timeless.
I freaking love Bee Gees. I've just learned to play some of their tunes on piano to transcribe the chord.
Oh nice.
Just love that. No guilty pleasures there. Yes, yeah. I also love the prog and the fusion and the metal and. Classical and jazz, but man, give me How Deep Is Your Love by Bee Gees any day of the week.
There you go. Yeah. What was your first instrument that you learned? Was it piano?
No, I started piano pretty late.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And didn't become serious until recently, to be honest.
Oh, wow.
Only for the past couple, 6, 7, 8 months, I've been practicing on a regular basis because, you know, just playing guitar can get a little stale. You need to keep the inspiration fresh. So my first instrument I played was actually a recorder.
Okay.
Yeah, everybody in Germany kind of, it was a thing where in school they offered you recorder classes for free or something. And so the kids would be out of the house another hour. And so I started playing recorder but then switched to the guitar straight away.
Was there a certain, like, because I know you've been listening to a lot of music at this point. Was there a certain, maybe song or band that inspired you during that switch to guitar?
I think that would, calling it like that would be giving it too much credit. As a kid, I didn't really have a specific master plan. I just liked guitar, to be honest. I had a cousin over My father had an acoustic guitar. He was jamming on that a couple chords. I thought that was really cool. Then my cousin came over one day, brought an electric guitar with an amplifier that had a distortion on it. And that, wow, that is so cool. I want to do that. Not the boring acoustic. I want to do that. So yeah, I think that's what inspired it. Plus all the music I listened to, pretty much all of it had a guitar in it. Mm. And my attention was always drawn towards the guitar back then.
Yeah. Nice.
Like Pink Floyd, yet I was listening to The Wall when I was 6 years old or something. And I always loved the guitar the most. I didn't even know what a bass was. I didn't know there was a bass guitar in there.
Yeah.
And when somebody explained it to me what a bass guitar is, I was like, that sounds kind of boring, right?
Right? It's so wrong how, at least back
then. So naive, but...
Yeah, I feel like there was a lot of... I've heard a lot of that, you know, like even like, you know, like in the States, like I've heard a lot of people say the same thing as far as just like, I want to play guitar, I want to play bass, you know what I mean? When like, you know, you take the bass out of some of these big songs, it's like it's not even the same song.
Little did we know.
Right? You know, it's like you wouldn't even have...
I love drums too.
Yeah.
If I had a choice between guitar and drums, I maybe would have chosen the drums even, but it's just not an option.
Right, right.
Yeah. But whenever I found some drums to bang on, I would always love that as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think about, you know, if you took out the bass and the drums and like Motown wouldn't even be Motown, you know, like.
And the guitar is, yeah, as I said, like Earth, Wind & Fire, September, you take a song, you can take away the guitar, the song will be intact, it'll be fine.
Right.
You take the guitar and the drums and the bass away, it's what is left, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, it depends on the kind of music, of course, yeah. But I, at the time, I was really into guitar-centric music.
Nice. Did you have any? Do you remember any favorites when you were, you know, picking it up and learning? And
yeah, so for sure, Pink Floyd was an early influence. My favorite band when I was a kid were the Rolling Stones.
Oh,
and I saw them live twice as a kid as well.
Oh wow!
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I was like 10 years old or so. Saw them twice.
Oh man.
I absolutely regret at age 9. That I did not join my father to see Pink Floyd, the Pulse tour in 1994, because he saw them twice, once in Munich, once in Prague. And at the time, I don't know, I was feeling rebellious or something. He asked me, "What, do you want to come and join me?" I said, "No, Pink Floyd is not cool." And of course, the reason I would think that they're not cool is because my uncle or my cousin told me they're not cool. And you didn't, you want to rebel against your parents a little bit. So I regret not seeing that tour. That's a big regret. So I was massively into Pink Floyd. Then I got into Nirvana.
Oh, well, yeah.
And that opened the door up towards heavier music.
Nice.
Then I got hugely into Metallica. And then I got into Dream Theater and the prog stuff. From there, it led me to the fusion stuff, like Mike Stern, Pat Metheny, still a huge, huge influence.
Yeah.
Yeah, Chick Corea.
Yeah.
Led me towards that direction.
Nice.
That was kind of the progression of things.
And what age were you when you went to school for a guitar? You were in like a conservatory, right? What age was that?
So I first had classical lessons when I was in fifth grade maybe. But she was my music teacher. She was teaching me guitar, Frau Fink, Miss Fink. Hmm. She was freaking awful. She was just a terrible, terrible, terrible teacher.
Oh no!
And the fact that she didn't break me. And I still kept going. That really meant something. that really meant its destiny.
As it should, yeah.
So that was really horrible, horrendous classical lessons. I then sought out a guy. So I was raised in a village, and there was a guy teaching in the next bigger town, and he would come to my village every once in a while to teach kids locally. Mm. And I took that opportunity to take lessons with that guy. His name was Manfred Kepsch. And he was my first proper serious teacher. And he then made me go to conservatory, which is where he taught as well. And so I, apart from having the one-on-one lessons with him, I also joined the big band, the improv band, some theory courses and stuff like that. So that was the kind of preparation towards moving to an even bigger city and attending music college, which is what happened next. So when I was 18, I went to Dresden College of Music, Karl Maria von Weber, which is where I spent 5 years studying. And then I took a 5-year break, and then I started teaching there a couple of years later.
Wow. So
that became full circle. Yeah.
Wow. Tell me a little bit of, as far as for that experience, you know, as far as like, you know, going to a, or playing music at a conservatory, was, were there some times where it was just like really stressful? Like, what were some like memorable takeaways, I guess, when
yeah.
you were.
Yeah. I think this is something that any guitar player who ever tried to play in a big band, I think, can relate to. Because us guitarists, we were horrible sight readers, right?
Right.
Notorious. Yeah. And so am I. So I go to big band, and they give me these. I was 15, 14 at the time, and they give me these sheets. And every single chord on it is spelled out as notes, not as chord symbols. And there were some chord symbols too, but the chord symbols were A7 sharp 9 flat 5 or mid 3 over C sharp.
Yeah.
That would be the chord symbol. And that would be one quarter note and then onto the next one. And that is syncopated by a 16th note and stuff like that. It was just wild. It was completely, I cannot possibly process this information. And I was just sit there with the guitar turned down in those rehearsals and just strum along, you know, and just play pretend. Because to be honest, you have to work your ass off to play that stuff.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you can't hear the guitar anyway because it's buried.
Right, yeah,
by all the horns and drums and piano.
You're copying,
and the conductor doesn't give a shit because the conductor only worries about the drums and the brass and the piano. And so yeah, I was just miming along essentially.
Yeah, that's so interesting because yeah, I spoke to another guitarist, Jamie Leeming, and he kind of had he said something similar too. He's like, yeah, like it's just guitarists aren't known for like sight reading, you know. And I wonder why that is, you know. I wonder if it's
not part
just
of the culture. I think it's not part of the tradition of the instrument. Especially the electric guitar is an instrument. It's a mostly a rock, primarily a rock instrument, right?
Right.
As we know it today, it's the symbol of rebellion.
Right.
And I think the way it's taught, it's mostly taught. Or it's mostly learned autodidactically, meaning everybody learns it by themselves, self-taught. Most people are self-taught. They're not trained. And there's the availability of tablature. There's also the thing is, though, you don't need to read much if you're an electric guitar player. Because what scenarios are you realistically going to read in unless you join an orchestra or a big band? Because if you join a rock band, you're not going to read music. If you do studio sessions, you might, but most of the studio sessions I've attended as a session player have been, here's a chord chart, here's the track, play something that fits. And you come up with it yourself. So you're much more reliant on your ear, for example, to pick out music than it is to this through charts. The same when I play with my band and I learn all these cover tunes, that God knows, we learn whatever song there is, Highway to Hell by AC/DC or whatever, right?
Yeah,
you don't.
Yeah.
What do you do when you learn a classical piece? You seek out the official score that was written by the person who wrote it, and you learn that. But what are you going to do with Highway to Hell? There is no official score because the music wasn't written on paper and then given to musicians. Because the music was made by people
who
got together in a room and started jamming a tune and then recorded it.
Yeah, they say, I wrote this.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's part of the culture. And in the same way that they didn't write it out, I'm not learning it by reading it. I'm learning it by listening to it and absorbing the information that way.
That's a great point you make, and that makes a lot of sense, too. Yeah, because it just seems like, you know, because I know, like, classic guitar obviously is, you know, been around for, you know, centuries and centuries, or just like how the guitar has evolved, right? But I think once the
lute has been around for a long time. I think I'm not sure. I think the Spanish classical guitar came on much, much later than the lute. Yeah, but it's like it wasn't really until Andrés Segovia, who revolutionized the classical guitar, that the classical guitar became such a big thing.
Yeah.
I'm not too sure about the history of it anyway, so I wouldn't make any binding statements here.
Yeah, I think you do have a point though. From once the electric guitar, you know, came into play, it's just like, Yeah, when it comes to sight reading, when I just seemed like that was kind of buried.
I mean, it's a great opportunity too, because if you're a good reader, you can score a lot of jobs and you will not have a lot of competition.
Do in that conservatory, was there like jazz involved too, or was it a mix of like classical and jazz, or?
It was mostly jazz. Yeah, mostly jazz, a little bit of rock here and there, but then I progressed to college, which was almost exclusively jazz. And also, yeah, it was split. It was, let's say, three quarters jazz and then one quarter classical acoustic guitar. Yeah, but I didn't pursue that very seriously, to be honest. I liked college, but I knew kind of too early on what I was good at and what I wanted to pursue. And so I focused really, really on the electric guitar.
It's interesting. I took a semester of like a big band jazz in a community college at one time,
Oh, yeah.
and
Then you'll know.
yeah, like once entering, I was like, I'm out of my league, but I'm gonna keep doing this. And then I remember speaking to one of the bass players, upright bass player. He was like, one of the things was like, oh, if there's any book to learn to help with just like playing lines, like the Charlie Parker Omni book is like, everyone has a copy of this.
Bible.
Like, yeah, it's like everyone has a copy of this.
Yeah,
Like,
and that
have
you
that.
see that that music is not written for guitar, so there's no tablature for it. Why would there be? But would we make a tablature for a piano or a violin or anybody who wants to play that music? No. Written music, sheet music, is the universal language, or written language of music. And I mean, I can read. It's just not that I'm not a great sight reader, but I think it's crucial to be able to read, because you know what? There's so much music out there, and unless the only thing you ever want to play is AC/DC and Van Halen, you better learn how to read, because there's so much information to be absorbed.
Definitely. And then of course, I would say you're definitely one of the you and Tom Quayle, definitely one of the mean, probably one of the first few as far as really getting a hold of this online teaching guitar thing, right? From the MySpace. Like, do you remember
Oh my
do
God,
you
yeah.
do you remember that moment when you're like, you know what, I'm gonna start doing this, and kind of like the initial
Yeah,
response?
I think that was a realization that trickled down very slowly for me. There was never that point, I'm going to do this now. There are some early adopters, like very early YouTubers, like Justin Guitar, Justin Senderco. He's a guy that adopted the online teaching realm extremely early and extremely seriously in a very dedicated manner. But for me, it was like, today I feel like making a video and putting it up there. And maybe I put up one a month or one every couple months. It was very innocent. It was very slow. It was a very slow start at first. Yeah, there was never really that moment, that's what I'm going to do now. It's just, it felt natural to me. If I thought I had something cool to share, why not put it up there? I
Very
mean,
cool.
that's today. Today, that is completely normal. But back in 2008, 9, where I think I uploaded my first video on YouTube in 2007, that was not normal. I was literally the first guy at my college to upload some of their playing to YouTube. And that got me 3,000 views or something, and that was mind blowing. That was literally mind blowing. I remember I saw this guy, Sam Colson, the great guitar player from the UK. I remember going to his YouTube channel in 2010 or something, and I remember seeing that he had 8,000 subscribers, and my jaw dropped. I couldn't believe 8,000 subscribers. That guy must be rich. That's what I thought, you know? And nowadays, 8,000 subscribers. That's like nothing these days, you know?
It's like, keep on doing it.
That's so crazy how our perception has changed of that.
And like
It was so innocent back in the day, wasn't it?
And then the algorithms weren't, so like controlled, and just created in such a weird way, where It wasn't just like an open traffic lane like it was back then, where it's just like anyone's looking at it. You know, it's so much more complex and complicated now, and every, you know,
Yeah,
obviously the
even
saturation.
search results are interesting nowadays because you search something, you get a couple of search results based on what you searched for, and then you get a bunch of results based on what YouTube thinks you want to watch. It's very interesting. I think the reason for that happening, though, is the fact that there was a time when, before Instagram became big, that everybody uploaded every 5 second clip they took of their phone onto YouTube, and you would look for something, and instead of finding like an official video, music video, you'd find 500 10 second clips of a live show that are really poor in quality. I think it's to battle that. Nowadays there's the Instagram story for that.
Yeah,
You have these
exactly.
like less produced types of content, super spontaneous. So yeah, it's very interesting the functionality of these platforms, or the way we perceive them. It shifts all the time, right?
Yeah.
You have to really keep up. And I once spoke to a therapist, and he said something amazing to me. He said, "You know what the what is the it's just a theory, but what's the number one biggest factor for reliable success? What would you think that is?" I didn't get it.
Oh,
I so it was no idea. Is that adaptability?
no.
I guess that's very, very true.
Stay resilient. That makes sense. A lot of sense. A lot of sense.
And yeah, and adapt to whatever is coming out at the time. So, you know, maybe you'd be the first guitar podcast
Maybe we'll see.
the metaverse.
I was gonna ask you, so you did your 5 years in the conservatory, you graduated from there, and then
So I have to say one thing. In Germany,
sure.
a conservatory is not like college. So it's more like it was more like a public music school for kids and people in their teens, and then
Okay.
you go to college from there. The college is then
Oh,
what? Yeah. So
interesting.
the conservatory is more of the early was the early stages of my development when I would get regular lessons. First time, and then that was a couple of years, yeah, 4 or 5 years or so. And then when I was 19, I moved to Dresden and went to college, and that was where the serious education started.
Okay. Did you always have the intention to teach guitar, or was it something that kind of fell in your lap, or you just kind of got inspired one day when you decided to start teaching?
Well, I have a very analytical mind, so I always love to look at a process, an abstract process such as learning the fretboard, for example, and putting that into very precise language. I think it's very interesting, or to make waterproof definitions of various phenomena. I just love to put. I mean, I'm a nerd. Yeah, I'm a geeky dude. I like to overthink, and that part of me is what really keeps teaching fresh. Which is why I do not teach beginners, because beginners are often not sure whether they even want to play guitar, they want to try themselves out, and there's much better teachers for that. I'm a good teacher for somebody who wants to get really deep into this
Oh, wow.
and wants to spend the time. Yeah, but you know, it's I'm trying to balance it. I do teach a little bit every day, 1 or 2 hours, and I write these courses, but ultimately, my thing is really to be an artist, to be a musician, to be a performer, to be a writer. That is my long-term number one goal. And the tuition, I love to teach, and it's just the most reliable way to keep funding that, you know? So I can
Awesome.
take risks outside of in the outside music world more.
Awesome. Very cool. And then I know we were talking a little bit off air as far as, you are releasing a some new music, another album yourself, that you're going to be releasing pretty soon. Was it this year? Or tell me a little bit as far
Yeah, I
as for
mean,
that.
I was gonna release the single next month.
Oh,
There's
nice.
I do have a music video for it. The music is done. I'm just trying now to think think I'm talking to some labels and stuff. I'm trying to just find the best way to release this music to the public. There's some angles that I haven't considered, like, can you upload a single and merge it to an album on Spotify later, or will that remain a single and not be part of the album? Because if that's the case, then that's going to push my single back, because the rest of the album needs to be finished first. There's all these kinds of considerations that nowadays, as a solo artist, man, you have to do so many damn things. If I could wish for one thing, is that somebody would take these things completely off of me and I just focus on making the music.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I have to also have to be an entrepreneur, a publicist of some sorts.
Right.
And a website designer and, God, so I have to be so many things that are not directly related to music.
Right. As far as for the album goes, how it sounds, were there any type of sonic ideas that you wanted to implement this time that were kind of like different that you've ever done, or how did you approach it?
Well, I had a few mission statements that I really wanted to put into reality. First of all, it's my first vocal record. My first record as a singer.
Oh.
So the entire record has vocals on it. There was an instrumental on it, but I decided to cut it out because it didn't fit the rest of that song was written much earlier than the rest of the record, and it just didn't gel at the end of it. I might release that as a single sometime down the line. And sonically, I was going for progressive rock, progressive metal in the style of, you know, Toto, Genesis, Dream Theater. Some Michael Jackson influence is in there, some Muse, nice. Some Queen, all kinds of stuff. And I'm going for a modern cutting sound, but what I really don't like about modern records is how they all sound like this. They all sound in your face at all times.
Yeah.
And I wanted things to sound a bit wider and deeper. Like if you listen to, God knows, a good example is Metallica's Black Album. That is not an album that sounds like this, but it has depth to it. It sounds 3D.
That's true.
That's the kind of sound I'm going for. Of course, I'm not. My music is not as guitar driven. My music is actually more synth driven than anything. Piano and synth driven, because that's where I write most of my music. So I wanted to have some of that 70s, 80s. I just love how 70s and 80s records sound. So I wanted to capture some of that feel. Also 90s records. Some of that feel. And just make it a little more modern, a little more cutting, a little more aggressive.
Yeah, yeah, that's really neat. Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I definitely understand what you're saying as far as, you know, it's almost like there's more focus on the songs being louder than kind of like the presence, you know.
You have a great example of a rock record back there on the wall, the Rage Against the Machine record.
Oh, one of my favorites.
Yeah, so if you listen to that, you can hear how the drums are being played. You can hear how the drums are being bashed brutally, and you can hear how the room responds to that.
Yeah.
Whereas nowadays, with a lot of modern metal bands, all I hear is that somebody put a plug-in, clicked some notes, put the compressor on max, and then put that out as a record. All I hear with a lot of records nowadays is when I visualize music. I always visualize music. Like when I was a kid, I would visualize music. When the singer sang a really cool part, I would visualize myself singing that. When there was a guitar solo, I visualized myself playing that. Mm. When I listen to a record like The Battle of Los Angeles or a 90s Sepultura record or something,
yeah,
I can hear and I can visualize the drummer bashing the shit out of the drums. And all I hear nowadays music is somebody getting bored in front of the computer and clicking shit. Yeah. And that's something that I want to give that human physical energy back into music that is still very tight and very, very produced to an extent and modern, but I want to retain that human element that makes me visualize how something is being played. I think that's, for example, why in the prog genre, Dream Theater is still the king. Because you can still hear that these are actual performances that they record.
Very true. Very true. Yeah, I mean, even like for some music that I make, like, you know, it's funny today, there's so much there's so much technology where it almost makes an artist lazy in a sense, you know, where it's like for artists that are, you know, that want to perform and make the music, you know, it's like you almost have to, I don't know. It's almost like it's almost a very spoiled time, you know, for a lot of up and coming musicians.
How compare this? Think of movies in the 90s versus movies now, Hollywood movies. Everything is CGI nowadays.
Yeah.
And of course there's these CGI artists that put enormous amounts of talent and work into things, but it's not as impressive as practical effects.
Yeah.
Like when it's different when you know, oh, there's a guy in front of a green screen and then they make it look like the car flips over and explodes. That's kind of boring. But what if they actually do that?
Right.
What if they actually do that? That gives you a whole different level of immersion into the movie. Because you know what? You know there's somebody who risked their life to do that.
Right.
This really happened.
Right.
They had to go to all those lengths. They could have done it in CGI, but they decided to do it for real.
Yeah.
And that level of extra effort and extra, you know, extra heart and soul that goes into something like this, that's something that I try to retain on my music.
Mm. That's funny you say that, because that reminds me a lot of like Sam Raimi's Evil Dead 2, where he made a lot of those special effects himself, you know, just kind of like really astonishing stuff. Or even though this is in the 70s, The Exorcist, where they had a bunch of ice, you know, things of ice around the room to make it cold. You know, it wasn't a digital thing they put in, you know, so it's just like, wow. Like
some of those 90s movies just look incredible nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Because they like a movie like Seven, for example, all the sceneries look so freaking amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays they would just CGI that together. And the thing is, I think there's just nothing, there's no risk involved in that.
Mm. Yeah.
You know? And I think it shows.
Yeah. Yeah.
It shows, because you can always change it, and it becomes a little arbitrary in a sense.
Definitely.
And in the same way that when you, let's say you listen to Elton John, Tiny Dancer, and he plays that on piano and you listen to it. How did he play that? That was probably one take start to finish the way he played it. And you listen to how he plays that. Oh, he goes a bit softer here. He goes louder here. And then he plays that. Oh, he nails that line so beautifully. And that chord change is just gorgeous. And you have none of that in a lot of modern day production, because you would record that on MIDI and then quantize it, and everybody would sound the same.
Right, right.
The heart and soul is not retained in those performances.
Yeah, exactly. Well, definitely, I know we're going to be looking forward to that single, you know, once you drop that. I guess just a couple of questions, more questions for you. I guess, is there any music that you're listening to right now that you're super into that you've been listening to recently?
I listen to the same stuff always.
Really?
I'm still finishing up my record. I'm a full-time musician. It's like if you're a butcher, I'm not sure you want to eat salami when you get home. I keep up with my friends and colleagues. Like a guy like Mark Leggeri, when he releases a record, I have a listen to that and make sure I keep up to date with what's happening out there. But other than that, I've been a little bit out of the loop, to be honest with you.
Yeah, yeah.
I do have the music that I love. That I love and I know that gets me every time. That's what I still listen to.
Right. Yeah. Right. And I don't blame you for that. I tend to go back quite a bit, you know, so
yeah,
definitely understand that. Understand that. Well, Martin, I really appreciate you speaking with me today here on the 440. I guess lastly, you know, is there anything that you want to plug that your fans can keep an eye on for the upcoming weeks, or anything that you wanted to promote, you know?
Keep an eye out on my YouTube channel, Martin Miller on YouTube. That I'll drop my single there. I'll drop it on all the major streaming platforms with an album to follow up. I do have a bunch of masterclasses at jtcguitar.com. A picking masterclass, a hybrid picking masterclass, fretboard visualization masterclass, all kinds of stuff. Check out my band, the Martin Miller Session Band. Check out my website, martinmillerguitar.com. Yeah, all the info is on there.
Awesome. Well, once again, man, yeah, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Likewise, man. It was good talking to you.
Of course, likewise. Well, there you have it, folks. This is Drill Pal here on the 440 Guitar Podcast. We'll jam again soon, and have a good day.